All right. Once again, my name is Tarek. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is now time to introduce this morning's speaker. I was at a weekend convention up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a couple months ago, and I got to visit with Matthew a few times, and then I heard his talk on Saturday night, and then I remembered that Ralph, had him on our Thursday night call. And I remember being so moved on that Thursday night call. And once again, on the Saturday night talk at the convention, I was, my heart was touched. And it's just a incredibly, wonderfully kind presence when you're around Matthew. I'm just starting to get to know him. And so I enjoyed our brief conversations, and I incredibly enjoy listening to him share his experience. And you guys are in for a treat this morning. And with that, I give you Matthew M. from Santa Paula, California.
Thank you, Tarek. Thanks, you guys. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. It's much earlier here, so you're the first human beings I've talked to, so your patience and grace would be appreciated for this today. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993, so I'm 30 years sober. I got my sponsors, Bill Cleveland in Redondo Beach. And I loved it when Tarek texted me, said I could talk about the steps in my life, my story, anything. And I really want to talk about a few topics today about the bondage of self and how the steps relieve me of the bondage of self. When I got sober on May 16th, 1993, my brother had 12-stepped me on May 8th, on Mother's Day, a week before, but they couldn't find any place to put me, and I was in pretty bad shape. And so he called, or the phone rang, I thought it was him, to go to rehab. And I'd stayed up all night, getting ready for rehab. I was passed out on the floor with my head against the wall, and I picked up the phone, and it wasn't my brother. The only reason I answered the phone is I thought it was my ride to rehab. And it was this woman who told me my daughter was born. And there was a girl across town that was a young girl. I was 30 years old. She was 18. She was pregnant with my child, and her cousin or somebody was trying to get a hold of me. And so I woke up the day I got sober, and I went to find my car, and I found my car, and I went to the wrong hospital because that was the kind of stuff I used to do. And, in AA, they talk about these moments of clarity, and some of them are very unpleasant. And when I was walking out of the wrong hospital, I went to the hospital where I was born because that's where babies come from, and I'm selfish and self-centered. And I went to that hospital, and they weren't there. And I got in my crappy car, and I really thought, I could see clearly that I was the root of all my problems. I could see that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. I drank away some of the best jobs I ever had. I was a rock and roll musician touring around the country for 12 years. I was have 2 degrees. I was well educated. I have a family that loves me. And, I ended up in an apartment I hadn't paid rent on. I couldn't get a job. I owed everybody money. And it just became really clear that I was the biggest loser on the planet. And my reaction to that was not, it's so good, I'm going to rehab. Sitting in that car in that hospital parking lot early in the morning, I just decided to go home and kill myself. And I had a guy had left a gun in my apartment, and I knew, I kind of felt like I could do that. I felt like I had the courage to finally pull the trigger. I'd put that gun in my mouth late at night sometimes, but usually out of moments of extreme self-pity, And this time it wasn't valor. I wasn't trying to erase me so nobody would have problems with me. I was just afraid, really afraid. I didn't want to meet this baby. I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't want my mother to die. My mother had cancer nearby, and I could never seem to get out the door to visit her. I'd call her and say I was going to visit her. All this stuff was sitting in the car with me, the reality of life. And I had no tools. I've raised 4 children sober. None of them have ever seen me drink. I've been married a long time. I work in a very intense business. And I've just realized that life is a series of invitations to grow almost daily. And not just in alcoholics' lives. I watch my children be invited to grow. I watch my wife and the stuff she's had to work through in her life. And I didn't have the tools for all these invitations that were hanging over my head in the car. So I decided to kill myself, and I put my head on the steering wheel and I started the car, and my head bounced off the steering wheel because I hadn't driven the car in a long time, and it shook. It didn't just backfire. It kind of coughed, and my head bounced off the steering wheel. And I remembered the name of the right hospital. And I noticed your password to get into this meeting was mercy. I smiled this morning when I typed that in, and because, you know, a lot of people come here and they have a problem with God, and we can throw the we agnostics at them and all that stuff. But I don't think many of us would, if we really were thoughtful, would have a problem with grace. And that's an element of mercy, is grace, an unwarranted gift. And when that name of that right hospital came into my head, like, I didn't really know it then, but I know it now that that was a moment of grace. And the reason I know it in my bones is I practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I practice them. I've never worked a step in my life. I don't see that in the literature. I practice them. And I practice these spiritual principles. I practice these steps. I practice step 11. So I meditate. And if you guys meditate, and if Tarek's your sponsor, I have a feeling you do have an 11-step practice. If you try to meditate for longer than 5 minutes, 3 days in a row, the first thing you learn about yourself is you're not in charge of the thoughts that come into your head. They just randomly come into your head. And I was not trying to think of the name of that hospital. I was trying to get enough courage to go home and pull the trigger and blow my head off. I really can't describe how real that, the relief that I thought I was going to get, felt that day. And when the name of the right hospital came into my head, it was an involuntary electrical impulse in my brain. I did not want that. I did not welcome that. It just happened when my head bounced off the steering wheel and I drove to the right hospital. I didn't shoot myself. That's grace. By the definition of grace, it's a gift I didn't expect, I didn't earn, and it came out of nowhere involuntarily, and it gave me this gift, and I lived a little bit longer. I went to the hospital, and when I went into the hospital, Anna, this girl was there, and you know, and I'd forgotten that the last time I saw Anna, I had pushed her down a flight of stairs. She was 8.5 months pregnant that day. It was the last time I saw her, and I didn't do it to be cruel. I wasn't violent towards women. I was drunk. And I answered the door of my apartment, and she wanted to go to the doctor. She said, "You make sure you don't party today." I don't, you know, I was so funny to me. She called it a party, but I was already drunk. It was like 6 a.m. I'd been drinking all night, and I pushed her to get out of the doorway because she was unpleasant and uncomfortable for me that day. And I pushed her too hard. And I'd love to tell you, I ran down the stairs to see if she was okay, but I slammed the door and went inside and drank because that made the problem go away. So when I saw Anna in the hospital, and I was embarrassed, I saw her, I was hungover, I was in the clothes I'd been wearing for 3 days. I felt like a bum, and she was looked terrible. I don't know if you've ever seen a woman that just had a baby. She looked like a truck hit her, man. And she comes running towards me, and she's so excited to see me. She's happy to see me. And it just was humiliating. And as she got closer to me, this woman that I did not love, I could see something in her that was beautiful. And it confused me. She had a presence about her. Something changed in her. She just looked alive. And it made me feel really ugly and disgusting. I couldn't help but notice the difference between us. And she reached into this plastic, I don't know what it is, but she pulled out Phoebe, our daughter, and handed me Phoebe Rose. And man, Phoebe was beautiful, and she made me want to throw up, you know. And I'm here, all of you guys that identify with less than a year, it took me a really long time in recovery to figure out why I felt sick to my stomach on a day that most men feel transcendent love. On a day when you're supposed to see how beautiful the world is and what this amazing thing you did and the woman you love and this baby is this gift. And I just saw two really lovely women, and I was so disgusting. I was in the bondage of self. And when you're in the bondage of self, you just paint everything with your own ugliness. Can't think about anything but how it reflects on me or how I reflect on it. I couldn't even be there for them. I was there with me, and it was just disgusting. And I lied. I lied. The first thing I said in front of my daughter was a lie. I said, "Everything's going to be all right." I kind of knew it wasn't because I decided very calmly then to go kill myself. I didn't feel like I needed the courage anymore. I just couldn't live where they lived, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. I didn't even know how to get there anymore. I woke up every day trying not to drink and use, and every day I let myself down. I was physically racked. I weighed 108 pounds. I was 5'10". So I drove home to kill myself, and I ran up the stairs, and my brother was standing at the top of the stairs with a duffel bag in front of my door. That's grace. I didn't plan that. I went to the wrong hospital. Then I went to the right hospital and stayed for 3 minutes. And in that time, that early in the morning, my brother had come by, packed my stuff, and was just leaving my apartment because he didn't know where I was. And I couldn't get into where the gun was. So that's grace. That's mercy. That's a gift from whatever you want to call it. You know, I have a degree in religious studies, and I'm thirsty for information on the spirit and how different people approach it. And I think one of the most beautiful ways I've ever heard it described is the Advaita Hindu phrase, Brahman is the timeless plenitude of being. And when I look at you guys and listen to you this morning, and I listening to you laugh with each other and talk, and you're all up here on a Sunday in your meeting, I see that. I see that timeless plenitude, that great unfolding of energy, that this potential that I can either be clear-eyed and selfless and see it, or I can be in the bondage of self. And that's the thing I understand now. When I was newly sober, I heard some concepts of grace and things, and I struggled a little with the higher power. And because of my background, I thought God hated me. I was raised Catholic by nuns, and there was a lot of guilt. There was a lot of guilt for just being a human being. I remember this nun looked at me when I was 14 in eighth grade and said, if you're even thinking about sex, you're going to hell, you know. And I looked around the room and I thought, God, it's going to be crowded, you know. Just everybody I know is thinking about sex. But I was just being a regular human, having my biology turned on so that I would reproduce. And I felt terrified by my own thoughts. So when I came here, I heard these things like grace, and I thought stuff would happen. You know, like I got a decent crappy job instead of the terrible job I had a minute ago. And I did that job, and then I got a better job. And in fact, I'll talk about that. I was praying the prayer, relieve me from the God. Well, let's back up. Step three, turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now, I know Tarek is very well versed in the literature, but I know what it feels like to be new in AA. And I know when somebody says, are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and you read this literature, it can be very confusing. You know, I remember when my sponsor said, you will have a new employer. And I said, well, I don't even have an employer. I don't have an old one. And that just this, you know, God consciousness and all, I just agreed to it. You know, and my sponsor and I knelt down on the floor in this kitchen, and I didn't want to do that. I thought all of a sudden, I picked Jeffrey Dahmer to be my sponsor. He said, we're going to kneel down and hold hands, and I'm going to say this prayer. And he said, God, I offer myself to you. And I said, God, I offer myself to you. And he said, to do with me and to build with me as thou wilt. And I said, to do with me and to build with me as thou wilt. And he said, relieve me of the bondage of self that I might better do your will. And man, I heard that. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Because when I was newly sober, my first 6 to 9 months, I was skittish and intense and awkward, and I felt alien. And the night I got out of rehab, 30 days after my brother took me there, I walked in my apartment. There was a party going on, and I lived there by myself. So I ran away from my apartment. I went to a meeting, and I called AA. There was a meeting right across the street from where I was standing in the phone booth. And I ended up moving in with my mom and my dad. My mom was dying of cancer, and my dad was her faithful husband for 45 years. He was beside himself. And I moved into that house. And at first I just felt awkward and weird. So I just go to a morning meeting, and then I get home and feel weird and awkward because they were kind and loving and they didn't hold my past against me. And I had just come from the ruthless criminal class of people. And so I go to the noon meeting, and you people, I didn't understand you either. Everybody was hugging each other and acting like everything was all right. And everything wasn't all right in my life. And I went back to my parents' house, and I'd get squirrely and go to a night meeting. That's what I was doing. And it turns out it doesn't matter why you do it. It just matters that you do it. you know, and I came to believe one day, I don't remember when it happened. I just remember I saw my parents and thought how beautiful they were, how beautiful their love was. Like it just appeared. And I look at it now and I think, oh, I got enough relief from the bondage of self to see what was in front of me. Grace doesn't come in the mailbox like an Amazon package. Grace is all around me. I'm swimming in it. I just can't see it because I'm in the bondage of self. So my brother called, you know, I had this job working from midnight to 4 a.m. at a loading dock. And then I delivered packages during the day. And I went to these 3 meetings and I had a real set group of night meetings with a group of guys I'd fallen in with. And my sponsor was there. And my brother got me a job interview and I was doing step 3, but I didn't know what it meant. You know, I turned my will, my life over to the care of God. And I went to this job interview and the guy sat down and, you know, I had 2 degrees, but I'd gone to a party for 12 years with my guitar and I'd been fired from jobs that were humiliating that I got fired from. Like the way I got Anna pregnant is I was her boss at a restaurant. I was her manager and she liked to party like I did, you know? So I went to this interview and I did well. I just was relaxed and, you know, I the job wasn't challenging, but it paid well. It was a warehouse manager job and I was certainly qualified to do that. And the guy said, you know, I think I'm going to give you the job. I really love your brother. You seem like you got it on the ball and it's going to be a salary. So all of a sudden I could pay more child support. I could save some money, get out of my parents' house. I could buy a car that ran every time I tried to start it, you know, like all that stuff when you're new that you forget how uncomfortable you are all the time. And I felt like this is grace. This is a gift from God. And I drove over to my brother's work. He worked nearby. He owned a company. And I told him I got the job. And he said, when do you start? And I go, I start 6 p.m. on Monday. And he goes, what do you mean 6 p.m.? And I said, well, it's a late shift at a warehouse for air freight. And he goes, you can't take that job. And I said, why not? And he said, 6 o'clock at night, your Monday night men's stag is 8:30. Tuesday, you have the step study at 7:30. Wednesday, you go to the beach meeting. He goes, those are all night meetings. You can't take that job. And I said, man, there are a lot of jobs, you know? And he said, look, you think you can take this for granted? I was like 9 months sober, I think at the time. I just thought he was crazy. I thought he'd been infected with that weird AA and sickness of this is all there is in the world. And you don't really go out there and do real stuff. And I went home to my parents' house and just happy I got a new job. And I went to my meeting that night and I told my sponsor I got a job. He goes, man, that's so great, that warehouse job. And he said, yeah. And he goes, good, man, you can pay more child support. And I said, yeah, actually, that was one of the first things I thought. He said, when do you start? I said, I start Monday at 6 p.m. And he goes, what? You can't take that job. And I didn't take the job. And that's step 3. I'm self-will run riot on my own. I'm in the bondage of self thinking you guys don't understand and I need stuff that you're not talking about. And the 2 people that nursed me back to health, my brother that 12-stepped me and my sponsor that patiently and lovingly sponsored me, both immediately said, don't do that. And I didn't do that. And my experience is once you get some relief from the bondage of self, you can see the grace all around you. Now, I wasn't happy that I turned that job down, but I just kept doing the jobs I had. I was going to my meetings. And then one day at the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, I told my sponsor, I'm praying that prayer every morning, relieve me of the bondage of self. My sponsor smokes cigars, sits out in front of the meeting with a bunch of us. And he looked at me through the smoke. I'll never forget it. He squinted at me and said, why don't you help God relieve you of the bondage of self? And, you know, I'm a pretty smart guy. And I thought about that for a minute. And I go, what are you, like the Riddler? How do I do that? And he said, why don't you go help somebody or do something nice and don't tell anybody? He really was trying to tell me to make a habit of that, but he thought I should try it once, you know. And so I really thought without saying it out loud, I thought, well, why would I do that, man? I'm living with my parents. I got a baby with a woman I'm not in love with. All right, I'll go be nice to somebody. And I walked into the big meeting. There's 100 guys every Monday night. And this guy raised his hand as a visitor. And he was Australian. So I'm going to be visiting once a month for the next year. And I thought, I'll remember that guy's name. His name was Kevin. I thought if he comes back next month, I'll greet him and I'll be relieved of the bondage himself. I'll just, you know, do this huge altruistic act. And he came back a month later and I ran across the room. I said, "Hey, Kevin, welcome back to the best meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. You landed in the epicenter of AA." And he said, "You remembered my name." I said, "Yeah." He said, "That's impressive. What do you do for a living?" And I mumbled that I stack newspapers on a loading dock. I was embarrassed. And I drive a delivery car during the day. And he said, "I couldn't really understand what you said. Come outside with me." And he gave me his business card. And he was vice president of an airline. And he said, "Hey, come to my office. Come to my office in a week. Bring your resume and dress up, wear a suit." And I went to this office. I looked terrible. You know, when you're a newcomer, you don't realize what a clown you are. I had a black suit, a white shirt, a black tie, and brown hush puppy shoes. And I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember hush puppies, but they look like bricks, man. And I wore them because the Beach Boys wore them. And the Beach Boys were kind of near where I grew up in Hawthorne. And they were cool when I bought them 10 years before that. So I'm in this suit with these hush puppy shoes. And I went in there and the woman from HR was so beautiful and she stared at my shoes and I felt embarrassed. I was sweating. I wanted to leave. And she didn't even ask me any resume questions. She's looking at my DMV. I've been arrested 3 times for DUI and I'm all sorts of stuff. And she goes into his office and I heard him yell at her, "He's not going to fly the damn planes. He's going to put people on them." And I got the job. You know, you surrender, you can see the grace. All I did was remember this guy's name and I got lifted out of poverty, really literally lifted out of poverty. And I went to that job and I went to my meetings and I was going to work one day and I bought a beautiful new guitar and I was standing at the bus stop and I realized I'm going to go home to my mom and dad. They don't want to see this guitar. I'm going to go, they'd be in my old bedroom. Nobody at work wants to see it because they don't trust me because I got hired by the vice president. I don't drink or chase women. And there's this woman standing next to me at the bus stop to go to our buses, to go to our cars late at night. And I just turned to her and said, can I show you this new guitar I bought? And she just shut me down. She said, "I don't look at strange men's guitars." And I got on the bus and I just felt that loneliness. I think some of us with time forget that you're lonely when you're new. You know, remember when you got your driver's license and you went to your best AA friend and you go, "Hey man, I got my driver's license." And they go, "Hey, you're 40 years old. You should have a driver's license." Like nobody's impressed with the things that are impressing you, you know? And so I just felt really crappy and I got on the bus and unfortunately, Lee, for her, we were shoved together on the bus. It was crowded. And she had a book in her hand I'd read. It was about Christianity. And I started talking to her and she was trying to relax and she felt uncomfortable. But then she started talking to me and I felt something I'd never felt before. I felt very comfortably at home with a strikingly beautiful woman. You know, and I'm a rock and roll musician. I've had lots of women, but usually I had an edge or I was drunk and I'm with this woman and I just felt this like this warmth between us. And I got off the bus and I started to walk away and I turned around and said, "Hey, you want to have dinner sometime?" And boy, did she not want to have dinner with me, man. She started yelling like, "Oh yeah, look at my guitar. I've read that book." And I just finally said, you know, no is a complete answer. Because I started to like my own company. I was doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taking commitments at meetings. I had my boys, you know, my boys. I was visiting my daughter and I held my head up high because I paid child support every 2 weeks when my check got cashed. And I just was different, you know, and I said, no is a complete answer. And she walked away and said, "Okay, I guess no." And I said, "I think we're missing something." And I don't know why I said that. I went home to my mom and my dad and told my dad I met this girl and she felt like home. And my dad said, "That's not over, son." Because my dad knew about grace. My dad was a very fiercely practicing Christian, not a religious person. He visited the sick, even if he didn't like it. And he taught us to go do things for people. And he knew things that I didn't know. He had clearer vision than I had. And I went to work the next day and bumped into her at the bus stop again. And she said, "I'm sorry, I was rude to you last night." And we went to have a cup of coffee
and missed the bus, and we missed all the buses, and we've been married for 28 years. She proposed to me 2 weeks after that first initial meeting. She proposed to me 17 days after I met her, and we've been married for 28 years. When you get surrender, when you surrender just a little, I just went and tried to do something nice for somebody, and it was a really small thing. I remember this guy's name because he was visiting and probably uncomfortable. And through that, this grace opened up. I got this job almost effortlessly. I didn't deserve the job. I didn't have the appropriate resume. I should not have been hired. Then I met this beautiful woman who decided I was what she wanted. You surrender, there's grace, there's love. I've seen it over and over. So that was, you know, step three. I just did not follow Self Will Run Riot when those about me were giving me advice and counsel that was wise, even if I didn't understand it. You know, the worst thing an alcoholic can say to his sponsor, to somebody trying to help him, is you don't understand. I remember that feeling, you don't understand. We do understand. You just can't believe it because you're in the bondage of self and you think you're so unique. I'm so unique. Don't you guys understand? I played CBGBs a year ago. Now I'm working at a goddamn restaurant. Now I'm working at a stack of newspapers. It's crazy. You can't know what it's like to be me, but you guys know what it's like to be an alcoholic. And you know what it's like to get in danger. And I followed your advice and the great things happened. You know, Pip and I had a couple of kids, and Anna and Phoebe showed up at the hospital first. They were there first to be with us when the baby was born. And we just all grew up together. And I want to talk about six and seven because there's guys with time here. You know, I was married for about 6 years to Philippa. We had a little boy and a little girl and a one-year-old and a four-year-old. Phoebe was eight, I think, or maybe seven. And my wife had a stroke. She had a massive stroke caused by a massager from Sharper Image. It tore a carotid artery, the wall away. And she was 38 years old and she was paralyzed and brain damaged. And that was 20 years ago and 21 years ago. Things changed, man. You know, I had, all of a sudden I got a one-year-old and a four-year-old and eight-year-old, and I'm it. I'm the diaper changer. I'm the lunch maker. I got the only job in the house. My wife had a great job. I got a different job. My wife worked for a union at British Airways. She made a lot of money, and we didn't have that money anymore. And I got a lot of advice. The third step thing, you know, I just got a new job when my wife had a stroke, and they wanted me to go to training in Chicago. I said, I can't go. And my sponsor said, why? And I said, my wife's in ICU. I'm not leaving. And he said, your wife lost her job. You got three kids. Go to training. We'll visit your wife in the hospital. Go to training. And I did. Step three. I actually ran it by Pip. I said, Bill's crazy. He wants me to go to training. And she said, look, we don't have any other money coming in. I'm going to jump to the 11th step and hopefully get back to that. The six and seven. So I got to tell you about an experience I had with prayer because of this. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand being away from her. I thought she was going to die in the hospital. I was studying hard during the day. I got a job in cardiovascular medicine at a biotech company, and I was studying it trying to learn how to do it. I was becoming a sales rep. And at night I lay in bed awake, terrified my wife was going to die. I checked my messages and you guys were leaving messages, my AA buddies, like, hey, we took her some food today. Hey, is it okay? We put up your Christmas tree. Hey, is it okay? We wrapped your presents, that kind of stuff. And 2 weeks in, I'm freaking out. I got to see her and I got two more weeks of training. So I went across the street. We were at an airport hotel in Chicago and I went across the street and got on a plane. I had friends in the airline business. I arranged a flight. I had no luggage. I went there and I went to the hospital. It got there about 9:30 at night and I had no luggage and the nurses saw me and she was the nurse was so relieved to see her husband. 78 men from the Monday Night Men's Stag visited my wife, not seven men, 10 times, 78 individual people visited my wife. And now finally a guy who's married to her shows up, you know, and I walk in there and she's laying in bed and she didn't look good. They'd all told me she looked good. She looked terrible. So I climbed into bed with her and I fell asleep, and I woke up in the middle of the night, like 3:00, 3:30. And I was terrified. I thought, God, I can't do this. I can't take care of these kids, do this job and take care of this woman. I want to be able to, but I can't. And I walked down the hall. The nurses had given me some soap and some towels. And I went into this big orthopedic shower, took off the clothes I flew in on. And I knelt down under that water and I prayed with such intensity. I said, God, please give me power. I know I'm not supposed to ask for that. I know I'm supposed to ask for the will and the power to carry it out. But man, I can't do this. This is too much for me. I want to do it, but I can't take care of that. I can't take care of this job. I'm in over my head in every category. And you guys, I woke up and I felt exactly the same. I was terrified. I could taste metal in my mouth. No relief came from that prayer. And I walked down the hall after I dried off. I sat there a while because I didn't want to go back in that room. And I walked in that room and she was asleep. So I didn't look at her because she was quite contorted from the stroke. She was, her face was messed up and she wasn't able to walk. And so I turned around, I sat down in this leather chair and I looked out the door and it was scary. ICU at night is scary. So I closed my eyes. And I realized I could feel my wife in the room. I could feel her presence. And I wondered if that was the sixth sense of being in love with somebody, that I could feel her with me. And I academically thought, if I closed my eyes, if I were blind, say, and I walked into a mansion, I bet I could find the room that Pip is in. I bet I could find her. I just thought that thought. So I got out of that chair. I was going to turn and look at her, but I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I was afraid. So I looked out the window. And what am I, like 7 years sober? I looked out the window, big picture window, and it's 4:00 in the morning, maybe 4:30. And there's these dark silhouettes, and I can't quite figure out what they are. And I was a little curious because there's blue and then black. And then I see things moving, and now I really don't know what it is. And slowly I realized they're trees and birds. And I kind of had this feeling like, wow, the world is beautiful. Like I hadn't been in, I've been in my head, and all of a sudden I saw this pretty stunning thing. And it just a little secret scene for me, you know, this in the room alone with my wife who's asleep. And I see this and I think, God, the world is beautiful. And I accidentally looked at my wife. I glanced down at her, and my wife has this really pale Welsh skin. My wife's from Great Britain, from Wales. And I just gasped and thought, God, I love this woman. And there was no fear. You know, I've prayed and prayed over the years. I've raised 4 children. I've had good things and hard things. And prayers have never changed my circumstances. But they have frequently changed my perception of my circumstances. And that fear never came back. Pip and I are happy as hell. I took her to Greece for our 25th anniversary. It's very challenging traveling with a paralyzed person. But we don't think about that. I had a guy say in AA, you know what AA teaches you? If you think about it, life sucks. But if you live it, it's beautiful, man. And we just live it. We're happy. We not only raised those 3 children, we adopted a child. When she was 12, we moved to Washington, and my daughter was 12. And she met this girl at school who was lovely and intelligent, and we could tell was being raised by bad people. And my wife convinced me to interject ourselves, and we got her. And my wife was paralyzed at the time. And I'm not her caregiver. She gives the care. I do everything that takes 2 hands, 2 legs, and a memory. So I'm going to finish with 6 and 7 because I love that Tara gave me the license to just talk about how these things work in my life. We moved into this beautiful house. I live in this really cool place in Southern California. It's 100 years old. It overlooks the valley and up in the hills. It's just really beautiful. And COVID hit, and I was an international leadership development officer for a biotech company. I was going all over the world to teach people how to be leaders. And I got grounded in COVID, and we were empty nesters. Our last 2 daughters had just moved out of the house, and we moved into this house. And it turned out in COVID, it wasn't Philippa that was hard to live with, my wife Pip, it was me. I didn't like being alone and not having stuff to go do, you know. But I noticed something because I practiced these steps. I practiced them very, very earnestly because I keep getting spiritual growth from them. And what happens in my life, in my house, in my marriage, is Pip will do something unkind or I'll interpret it as unkind or something selfish or thoughtless. And my bondage of self, I got antennas looking around for this kind of stuff. And I noticed this a few years ago. She'll do something and I'll be sort of understanding, but take a little note, you know, can't believe she just did that. And she goes down into her den and I come up into my office and then my head starts going like, what? After all you've done for her? You know, like I get Johnny Cochran wakes up here and starts making a case against my wife. You know, all the things I'm right about and all the things she's wrong about. And man, that case gets pretty irresistible. I got to go to court. I'm taking her to court. So I go downstairs. She's watching TV. She doesn't even know I'm coming. She doesn't even know we're not getting along. And I walk in there. She looks up at me and without raising my voice, I eviscerate her. I'm very good with words. And I say things perfectly and they have their effect. She looks scared. Then she looks guilty, but she disappears behind those eyes, those beautiful blue eyes. And I'm looking at her just completely devastated. And I feel like crap. And that's step six. If you start to feel bad for the stuff you do to get through life, that's a gift. That's step six. That's called my conscience. That's called my spirit trying to break through the bondage of self. And I look at this woman and I think, congratulations, Matthew. You just won an argument with a woman who's brain damaged. You have 2 degrees. You're an awesome person. And that awful feeling, that sick to my stomach feeling that I made my wife less sure of herself and less confident and sad and less safe just devastates me. I got pulled downstairs by the bondage of self and I got sent back upstairs by God. And I'd sit at this desk and think, I am entirely ready to never do that again. Awareness is very important in this program. Step six is awareness. Step eight is awareness, then action. Awareness, then action. Awareness, then action. So what do? I can't relieve myself of the bondage of self. God takes away my character defects, but I'm ready. So what would happen is I'd start to notice Johnny wake up. Mr. Cochran would like to talk to me. Something happened. And I'd go, you know, that's great. And he'd make a little case and I'd put it on the side of my desk, right? Now I put another one there, but I didn't go to court. She doesn't know that I was temporarily unhappy with the way she loved me for a minute. And I pushed those cases into my, those imaginary court cases, I pushed them into my wastebasket. And you know what the gift is? Surrender, grace, love. The gift of not being an asshole to my beautiful wife is that she unfolds in front of me. She becomes confident and kind. She becomes sure of herself again. She says things that differ from me, and I learn things. She wants to go places I don't want to go, and I have a great adventure. You know, I don't know how to describe what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me. I can tell you I have so many examples of surrender happening, seeing the grace that's always with me. You know, I talked about prayer, and praying changes my perception. You know, meditation is a huge part of my life. When I was about 10-15 years sober, no, what am I, 30, 11 years sober, I was coming apart at the seams. I was doing all the right stuff. I was sponsoring people and advancing in my job. And I felt empty. And my grand sponsor said, are you okay? And I said, no. He said, "What? Well, how can I help? I said, I'm not meditating very much. I'm really busy. And he goes, I'll call you every morning. And he called me every morning at 6 a.m. We meditated for 5 minutes, just silently meditated. Then 5 minutes was kid stuff. We did it for 10 minutes. Then it got up to 30 minutes. We did it every day. And then another guy wanted to join us. And then another guy. So we got a conference call. Now there's 47 people. We've been doing it for 19 years. And it changed me. It created a space inside me that everything is safe, where I'm just presence awareness, where all my conditioning and my political views and my upbringing and who my parents were and what my wife is like, it all doesn't matter when you get to that stillness. All you can find there is awareness. And I know that's what's alive in you. So I'm not lonely. It says in the 11th step, in the 12 and 12, one of the great gifts of meditation is you're not alone anymore. I've had to deal with things. I'd adopt this girl. That was a hard fight. I've been to the mental hospital when my son was on suicide watch. And I didn't go there with advice, and I didn't go there with the ego trip called guilt. I went there with presence awareness. And now my son meditates every day, twice a day. He did that on his own. I took him to a little class and he's run with it. He's fine now. This program, if I keep mining these steps for spiritual growth, I keep getting it. You know, I didn't come to AA to become a better person, but I keep accepting these invitations to grow because finally I have the tools to accept the invitations. And I accept the invitations to grow because I like the view from here. I don't even know what it's going to look like tomorrow. I can't wait to find out. Anyway, I'm getting to the point now. I'm going to start being redundant. Tarek, thank you for inviting me here. Losing my voice. Thanks, you guys.
Incredible talk. I think I could have listened to you for the rest of the day, to be honest. That was beautiful. There were so many things that you mentioned that I want to revisit quickly. The idea of receiving invitations to grow on a continuous basis, and how we will not be aware of the invitation when we are completely identified with our mind, which is what we call the bondage of self. You made a reference about not working the steps and the practices, and that is such a subtle nuance that can impact the way we live these steps when they're embodied in practices. And then that you gave a very stark image of, you know, when we are overly identified or fixated with different aspects of our personality or our lives and the circumstances, then that bondage takes place and we paint the world with our ugliness. And that just struck me deeply because I know how I have been that, that source of ugliness at times, you know, coming to believe in the beauty you saw in your parents and their love as a version of coming to believe in our second step, that we, you know, so many of us struggle with this idea, like I have to figure this God idea out and conception out. But when it can be simplified to witnessing beauty is coming to believe. And I just thought that was incredibly powerful. And then the wonderful examples you gave about the decisions with jobs, you know, intellectual sense says I need to take a job to get a paycheck, to pay child support, to take care of my family. And we're asking you, we don't want you to follow reason or logic or intellectual sense. We want you to do the one thing that doesn't make any sense. And that is embodied in the third step. The ability to see grace and mercy when we're not identified with our minds in that bondage. And the last thing I want to say, which I thought was beautiful and hadn't heard it put this way. I am sometimes guilty of praying because I want to change the outcome. And I like to consult with my higher power and explain to him how he could do a little bit better job if he would just listen to me. And you said prayer does not change the circumstances. Typically it changes my perception, which will change the lived experience of those circumstances. And that is one of the many things I'll walk away with today. Just beautiful. Matthew, thank you so much, brother. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Guys.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me.
No, it was our pleasure as well. All right, guys. Unmute yourself if you want to give some props to our friend here who shared himself with us, opened his heart with us. If you have a question, we've got time. You guys know we don't punch a clock on this meeting. A bunch of us are going to stay on. Yeah, I'm going to let you guys have at it if you like, and I'm going to stop the recording now.